Welcome to another segment of the Gay Bar Archive Show, where we explore gay history one bar at a time. I'm your host, Art Smith, and my guest today is Alan Kachin. Welcome, Alan. It's a pleasure to have you here today.
Hi, I'm really honored, you know, to have you today talk about some of the places that I hold quite dear to myself. And to a lot of other people.
Yes, I've been finding out more and more as I post things about bars from the past, how many people have expressed their appreciation for, you know, rekindling those memories and bringing back, you know, fond thoughts of what they did 20, 30, 40 years ago and the places that had kind of slipped away from our memories. So this project has been very rewarding for me.
I think you should be rewarded for that. The unfortunate thing is that gay bars today have become generic. They have no personality and they cater to a customer base which is gender neutral, regardless of straight or gay. And I have always been gay and always felt not exclusive for a gay community, but to cater to my community.
Right.
Today it's about the dollar.
You've had quite an interesting history in the gay bar scene. As I understand it, you kind of got your feet wet in the gay bar scene in the Atlantic City area in New Jersey several decades back.
Yes, in the late 60s, I opened a straight bar in Brigantine, New Jersey, which is right next to Atlantic City, and went from there to assist Alan Werber at the Chester Inn, opening up a bar in that hotel, which was one of the prime motivators of gay life in Atlantic City. I also worked at the Chester Inn. At the Chez Paris as a bartender. So I had my hands in the bar business 60 years.
Now, what was the Chester Inn like?
Chester Inn had about 75 rooms. It was an old style Atlantic City hotel. No private baths, shower rooms and so forth. But it was the largest venue in Atlantic City on a street that was predominantly gay. At one time, I think there was about five gay bars, as well as several gay restaurants, and a mix of straight and gay guest houses, and the Chester Inn being the largest. And Alan Werber did an exceptional job there, opened a restaurant, did the gay bar. And I know that a lot of people in my age group have a great fond memories of the Chester Inn.
And the Chester Inn, it was one of the first bars that I discovered in my research of that area. And considering the fact that we're talking 60 years ago, the graphics they used in their ad were a little bit blatantly gay. I mean, a chiseled torso of a guy with a sunburst arched over his back. They weren't hiding. There was no doubt that was a gay male oriented facility, just looking even at their ad without saying the word gay. So it was pretty revolutionary, I would think, back in the 60s to be that bold.
You know, I have always felt that in business, merchandising is very important. However, the group of people that you center your business on, you have to focus primarily on them. And since I wanted to open a bar that catered specifically to gay people, I wanted it to be in everybody's face. And I spoke to Alan about that. And I felt that we were all coming out of the closet. I would like to give credit where credit is due. Bobby Jones and two of his partners, Cliff Shute and one other gentleman, opened the Chez Paris and made a gay club. And I don't know if very many people realize this. In New Jersey, it was not only illegal to serve gay people alcoholic beverages, but it was illegal for gay people to dance. And they opened a disco on their second floor. And I was one of the bartenders and assisted them in putting the bar together. At that time, people started to dance, not holding hands with hands around the waist, but kind of like this. It was the beginning of individual people dancing with someone else, but looking like they're dancing by themselves. And the Chez Paris was raided, and they took it to court. And when the judge asked the enforcement agency for the New Jersey Liquor Board, so you're telling me that men were dancing with men? Yes, men were dancing with men. And how were they dancing? Did they have their hands around the other person's waist and was up close, like a foxtrot or a general slow waltz or something like that? He said no, they were all going like this. Well, were they touching? No, they weren't touching. And the judge said, that's not dancing. I don't even know what the hell that is. And this case is thrown out, dismissed without prejudice. And that was it. From that moment on, dancing between men in the state of New Jersey became legal. And I don't think very many people know that. And I believe that Bob Jones deserves a lot of credit, along with Cliff Shute, for that. As to Atlantic City, at that point, I had some other business interests that I took care of, and then went on to Philadelphia.
Now, when you went to Philadelphia, you opened a club that was called Equus. And Equus is very well known to people from that era in the Philadelphia neighborhoods. I've heard a lot of people talking about it and having great stories to tell about it. What was Equus before you opened it?
It was called the Pepper Box.
Oh, that's right. And it was a gay bar then as well, correct?
It was a gay bar in several iterations prior to Equus, but they seemed to open and close. Again, formula is very important. I don't believe in copying other people's businesses. I like getting in there and putting together, again, what I feel my community is looking for. But also, I like being in your face. When we were going to open Equus, we had no idea that it was going to become what it did eventually. At the Miss America pageant, had a float produced and placed in the parade. And here is this float with good-looking, well-dressed guys on this float going down the boardwalk in Atlantic City in 1977, introducing this bar, club, nightclub, restaurant that was going to open in Philadelphia in a short time. And lo and behold, we took first place in the commercial division, which really freaked me out because 99.9% of the people on the boardwalk had no idea what they were looking at. And again, that's what I do. Then we had planes flying over the beach in Atlantic City. And at that time, Anita Bryant was on her rant and rave. And we had these airplanes with the pulling the banners behind it. And the banner, Anita hates Equus in Philly. And just keep putting it in their face over and over and over again. And then we finally opened Equus in the fall of 77. And we were almost a success until several neighbors, along with several investors and other people, went against me to get a dance license. So in Philadelphia, in order to have dancing, you need a dance license. You just can't have it. So what I did in order to get the dance license, again, in your face, I put a disco on the second floor, and a show in New York, which was quite popular, was called the Hot L Baltimore. And that's what I did. I bought furniture from secondhand dealers. I made it as garish as possible, called it the Hot L Baltimore Lounge, and became one of the favorite spots for so many people playing the disco music that they were not allowed to dance to. And then finally, I invited several neighbors to dinner. And with two other very interesting people. One was the governor, Milton Schaap, of Pennsylvania. And the other one was the district attorney who would go on to become the governor, Ed Rendell. So between having these people that wanted to put me out of business, two of the largest reputation, well, I mean the governor and the district attorney of Philadelphia, on the other side of the table, while I just sat there and never mentioned anything about dancing, served them dinner, and just was a genial host along with Donald Cook and my partner at the time. And we got the dance license. And then Equus really took off.
Now, when you were coming up with this concept for Equus, first of all, how did you come about the name? Where did the name come from?
Again, Bobby Jones. I was in the carnival business, and I also had work on the boardwalk, demonstrating gadgets near New York Avenue. And Bob was my best friend. And he left Atlantic City. And prior to leaving, he said to me, I'm opening a bar in Philly. It's called The Steps. And I bought it, and we are moving. So Bobby and his other half forever, Jimmy Massara, who lives in New Hope, Pennsylvania now, Bobby is deceased. We sat down and they said, you know, we hate to lose you as our best friend. Why don't you open a bar in Philly? Okay, I'll think about it. And Bobby had, at that time, at carnival shows, the largest horse in the world, Goliath. And I simultaneously had the smallest horse in the world, which was no more than maybe 18 inches off the ground. And so traveled the carnival circuit. And when I decided to buy the Pepper Box and create a gay bar, I needed a name. And I said, you know, the horse, the little horse was lucky for me. And I'm not going to call it horse. So horse in Latin is Equus. And I won't tell you where I was sitting when I thought of that name, but if you can imagine, it's a room that's usually off of the bedroom. And that's how it got its name.
And at that time, that this was in the late 70s, right? 77 is when you opened.
Yes.
There was also a somewhat controversial play that had opened in London and then I think moved to New York by the same name, Equus, which had stirred up some controversy. So I'm sure that assisted in the popularity of the name of the club as well.
What a debacle. I had no idea what the play was, but it came to Philadelphia in a film with Malcolm McDowell. And so we were revving up for our first anniversary. And here down in Society Hill, I think it was Society Hill Movie or Playhouse, was this movie, Equus. And I said, wow, I'm gonna call him up. And I bought one entire show, every seat. And I hired a bus and I took my best customers, dinner, onto the bus with cocktails, down to the theater, and then gave out to regular customers, anyone that wanted to go see the film, tickets. The movie was packed. And the movie started. I had no idea what was going to happen. And let me tell you something. Those of you that have never seen Equus, that's really heavy duty. That is a mind something. I'm not going to use that other word. And all my customers, that when we were leaving, going to the bus, all you heard was, I need a drink now. I need a drink now. Oh, thank you for bringing that memory back to me.
Oh, you're welcome. And that story has continued to draw some controversy. If I'm not mistaken, not so very long ago, maybe 10 years or so, didn't Daniel Radcliffe also appear in the star role of in Equus?
Yes.
Fully nude, which of course was part of the controversy.
Well, quite popular for some people.
Absolutely. And this theme of force seemed to follow you through the bar. The first winter that you were open there was the year of the great blizzard of the Northeast, and practically closed down everything from I think New Jersey all the way up to New Hampshire. Pretty much everything was shut down, blanketed in feet of snow. And my recollection is that there is an interesting story about your bar and a Chinese New Year celebration that comes right up in that.
Oh, my God. That was something. That was my big anniversary. And it was the year of the horse. And I said, wow, this is really incredible. The Chinese year of the horse and our anniversary falling out on the same day. God only knew that there was going to be snow up to my shoulder. And we managed to get there to the front of the bar, and we started digging and digging. It was a tunnel to the front door of this bar. And my poor brother, who 17 years older than I, he's no longer with me. He had to go to Chinatown to get the Chinese food that we were having catered. And so I said to him, I don't know how you're going to do it, but you've got to. I don't care if 5 or 6 people show up or we eat it ourselves. Well, nevertheless, he did bring it, and it wasn't easy because it took him and 3 people from the Chinese restaurant to bring it from 12th and Race to 12th between Spruce and Locust. That was one of the busiest days we've ever had. You cannot keep a gay person in a house due to snow, earthquake, fire, wind, or catastrophe. When they want to go out, nothing will stop them.
And I'm sure that cemented your relationship with the community, because at a time when they were all trapped and unable to go to work or the grocery store or anywhere else, they had an opportunity to come and hang out at Equus and party and eat and drink and have a great time in the middle of a huge snowstorm.
They certainly did.
I'm sure
it gave us a great deal of support. I have to thank not just the people in Philly, but the people in South Jersey as well, and the suburbs of Philly, because, you know, we would do on Sunday, we only had a little dining room, and it only seated about 30 people. And we would do brunch on Sunday, and our brunch was $2.95 with two drinks. And it was an institution in Philly. We would do pretty close to 500 people for brunch. Eggs Benedict, a beautiful menu, and I put at $2.95. But the reasoning was, we opened at 1 o'clock. We had to sell food because a certain percentage of your business in Pennsylvania, in order to be open on Sunday, you had to do 51% in food as opposed to alcohol. So what do? You try to sell as much food as you possibly can in order to offset the alcohol, which was always a problem for us, because when you have all those people waiting to get into a dining room, they're at the bar drinking. And then we would have to open at 3 p.m. About 2 hours into it, the second floor, and open up the disco. So we were moving people constantly up and down for the brunch, dancing upstairs, cocktails, piano bar on the first floor. And it was just a constant rotation of people. And then at 6 o'clock, when we were winding it down at brunch, we would put an Italian buffet for $1 up on the second floor where the disco was, to get everybody off of the first floor, at least to clean that up a bit, to get that ready for the evening. So we always managed to move people.
Now, a lot of people don't realize how many states had those kind of rules back then. I know when I lived in Nashville, it was the same way. And a lot of the bars would do anything and everything they could think of to be able to be open on Sunday. So they might put out 20 bowls of potato chips and pretzels and charge a $5 cover, give you two free drinks, but they claimed the $5 was for the buffet, and that allowed them to stay open. These days, that's not so much the case anymore, but back then there were a lot of quirky little rules about what you could and couldn't do and what days you could be open and how late you could stay open. Now, I understand that Equus also had another unique distinction among, as far as I can tell so far, all gay bars in the entire world. There was a candy counter there that was only existed in Equus, as far as the bar scene was concerned. How did you manage to get authorized to sell packaged Godiva chocolates in a nightclub?
Now, John Wanamaker's department store was the only seller of Godiva chocolates. And one day, a gentleman sitting at the bar, I started talking with him, and he mentioned that he worked for Campbell Soup. And Campbell Soup was the distributor or the owner at that time of Godiva chocolates. We struck up a conversation. I said, you know, I would love to give everyone that has dinner in the dining room one of those Godiva gold coins. And he said, oh, well, that's easy. You can buy from us wholesale. And I said, oh, if I buy them from you wholesale, does that give me permission to buy all of the size boxes of chocolate? He said, yeah, I don't see why not. We can give you an exclusive. You're certainly not a department store. You're not a candy store. You are a restaurant. And that's how we snuck in under the fence. So there was only two places to buy Godiva in Philadelphia back in those days. And that was Equus as well as John Wanamaker. I always tried to, again, in your face, when La Cage aux Folles was playing at, I think it was the Translux Theater in Philadelphia. I'm not sure. I have to think about that. That was a long time ago. I called a distributor and I booked La Cage aux Folles. And we showed it simultaneously as it was being shown in the legitimate theater. We showed it in what was to become Equus's Cabaret Theater. And I did that on a few occasions with film. We used to do Monday Night at the Movies, and we would have some very, very fine films and some brand new films. You know, I'll put it this way. People don't realize we are everywhere. No matter where you go, there are gay people. And there is always, and especially at that time, we were all in the same boat. People looked down on us. We took a sign on Broad Street in Philadelphia, across from the Academy of Music. This is when Frank Rizzo was running for mayor for a second or third term. And he vowed that he was going to close all of these, I'll be polite, gay bars. And we had a sign put up that said, vote as if your life depended on it, because it does. So we always was in the forefront of a political message as well as selling alcohol. And I think the reason for that is my background. I never came out. I never felt it was necessary to ever tell anyone in my family or friends about my sexuality. I think that's silly. I didn't ask my mother or father if they were straight. What people are, they are. But I always felt that I'm not ashamed. And if you are, that's fine. I'm going to do battle for you, because one day you're going to walk down the street and not worry about that. And I'd like to just say this, if I may. I go to Wilton Manors, and I like to frequent a few places on Wilton Drive. I see guys holding hands with guys. If I did that in Philly or in Atlantic City back when I was young, I would have been beaten up or murdered. I am so proud to see that. I am overjoyed when I see the freedom that gay people have today. And maybe that's the reason why gay bars have changed so much, and that the older guys and women as well have a nostalgia for that period, is because we know what it felt like. You don't. We made it possible for you. Those that went before us lived in even more fear. So I am very proud of that. Very proud.
I can definitely relate to that. I know that when I first started coming out to the gay bar scene, which was in the late 70s, it was a very important part of your process of dealing with the fact that you were gay. Because prior, you know, if you were anywhere else, you were not allowed to express any idea or concept that you were gay. You could lose your job, you could lose your family, you could be evicted from your home. There were, you know, if you were renting, a lot of landlords would throw you out if they suspected that you were gay. And the gay bar scene was where we were able to be who we knew we were, and to be able to meet other people like ourselves, and to have conversations about political issues, to start forming organizations to help progress, you know, the cause of the gay community, be able to make it, you know, to clear the path. And that purpose doesn't really seem to exist any longer. Although I think once we start to see more gay bars disappear from the scene, it will become obvious that it really still is an important part of our community.
I just like to say something very quickly. When I finally decided that I wanted to go to a gay bar, I was 21. I don't drink. You know, alcohol is not something that interests me. I went into a bar on Snake Alley in Atlantic City, Louise's. It was a speakeasy from the Second World War for officers. They had military in Atlantic City during the Second World War, and the officers would go into that speakeasy. And then it turned into a gay bar. And when I first went in there, Paul Lepore was one of the owners, and the other gentleman that was his partner. I have to apologize at this moment. I don't remember his name, but I will. When I walked in, they said, "Oh, welcome. If you've been thrown out of your home, don't worry." "No, I'm okay. By the way, this is the bar, and you see that door? There's a little kitchen in there. And there's always food in there. So if you're hungry and your family cast you out, you come here and you eat every day." I was blown away. In fact, I feel like crying right now because you don't find this today. In those days, it wasn't about making money in these bars. It was about keeping you safe. The bar owner was just as much in jeopardy as you were as a customer. So we were all sitting in the same raft, and we all kept that raft from sinking. And that's a feeling that is so lost today. And it'll come again. What goes around comes around. You know, I think young people just take it for granted, which is fine. I will never take anything away from anyone. I think what's happening today is great. But little bars like that, a little speakeasy type bar that was there at a time when it was illegal, that offered you food and a place to sit down and not be judged, that's extraordinary.
Yeah, the bars were definitely much more community oriented in that aspect than a lot of the bar owners only owned one bar, maybe two, and they were generally in the bar. So you got to see the person who owned it. You felt a connection to the staff and the ownership and the other patrons like you don't see these days when you walk into a bar. You know, it was like family. It was like going home to grandmother's house.
You know, when you have dreams that you want to open a business and you choose whatever business that's going to be, I have a great deal of respect for people that work it. I have a lot of my friends that tell me, "Alan, you are the most intense person I have ever met." And I always say to them, I'm not intense. I'm focused. When I do something, I do it. I would go into Equus, help the cleaning staff clean, and I'm not bragging or trying to get a reward or this, that, and the other, but I loved my job. Equus, I didn't own it. I worked there. Every business that I've ever had, I was the best employee. I would go around and my customers would tease me with one of those little caddies and a broom cleaning up popcorn off the floor. And they used to say to me, Alan, don't you have a cleaning person? I said, yes, I have a cleaning person. And I'm also a cleaning person. You know, that's just what it is. It's not sitting there in a chair and being important. It's making your customers understand how important they are, that you're doing it not just to make a buck. Naturally, you go in business to earn a living. But, you know, many businesses spend a lot of money. And Equus was one business that contributed a tremendous amount of money to charities. And we would, the city would close Spruce Street once a year, and we would bring in a carnival and performances on an outdoor stage in order to raise money. It was just something we did. It was not just about being a business. It was about belonging to the people that supported us and looking after them as well. And then we went into the cabaret business as well and had world-renowned acts from New York. When the theaters were dark on Monday, we drove their performers to Equus to perform. Eartha Kitt, Tammy Grimes, Patti LuPone, Charles Pierce. I could go on and on and on. And our clientele, believe this, we would do on a weekend, I would say 90% gay. When we did theater and cabaret, a good 50-50. And these straight people that came in, there was respect and dignity for the gay community. And that's what made me proud. I didn't care if they accepted me. I wanted them to know that I accepted them. And they came in and had this good time with my kind of people. And that meant a great deal to me. And I was very proud of that. We became the number one cabaret theater in the city of Philadelphia. Every one of our performers would go to the local TV station in the morning to do a promo. And it was just absolutely not just fun. And it wasn't something that I made money from, because you could go and see Patti LuPone for $8. Well, we seated 100 people. She did two shows. $1,600 is not going to pay Patti LuPone. So the $10,000 that she charged us for her two performances was a gift to our community? Perhaps. Or perhaps it was making my ego feel good that I did something that no one else did. That's something I'll have to think about.
Well, I'll tell you, I was interviewing someone about a week ago who went to school in Philadelphia, to college, and is from the New York City metropolitan area. He now owns and operates the largest gay media placement company in the country, Rivendell Media. They place all of the major corporate ads and gay publications all across the country. And he was telling me the story when I interviewed him of his first gay bar experience. And it was in Philadelphia. He had worked up the nerve. Someone had pointed out walking through Philadelphia, that bar over there is a gay bar. Don't go in there. You know, stay away from there. And so one night he went in there and it was the bike stop. And he walked in there in his preppy little outfit, his little Izod shirt, and went through their little turnstile. And the doorman said to him, "This is a gay bar." And he said, "Yes, that's why I'm here." And he said, "This is your first time at a gay bar, isn't it?" And he said, "Yes." And the doorman said, "You know, this is jockstrap night, which means you need to take off your clothes and put them in a sack. And then you come into the bar in your jockstrap." He said, "But I don't think this is your kind of bar. Why don't you go around the corner and down the street to Equus?" And he said, when he got to Equus, it was like, you know, Dorothy in Oz. He said it was the most fabulous experience. It made him feel like he had gone to heaven. That it was, and this was at the time when you owned it, was the early 80s. And he said it was an epiphany that there were such places that were, you know, clean and elegant and fun and safe for a young gay man to go and meet other people like him. And so he had the fondest memories, even, you know, 40 years later, of what you did in Philadelphia in the late 70s and early 80s.
Well, I think that's wonderful. The only problem is I wouldn't have met him. I would have been at the bike stop.
And they're still operating.
Oh, yeah.
Amazingly. Yeah. So how long was Equus open? You closed in the mid-80s?
I sold it in 83. Okay. I opened an inn in Bucks County, Pennsylvania. And that was a huge project. So I couldn't do two at the same time.
Well, we definitely appreciate hearing the stories of your experience in Atlantic City and in Philadelphia, and the contribution you made to our gay nightlife in both places. I know that's not the end of your story, but we're going to end this segment here. Hey. And we'll talk about more of your history in the next segment. And that concludes another segment of the Gay Barchives podcast. You can find more podcasts at gaybarchives.com/podcast. We also have more information about this podcast and links to the other podcasts we have completed. We hope you enjoy your trip down memory lane.